Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Clayton M. Christensen, a well-known author, thought leader, and consultant. He's the Kim B. Clark Professor of Harvard Business School. He's the author, obviously, of very well-known books, and he's the five-time recipient of the McKinsey Award for the Harvard Business Review's Best Article. In 2011, he was named the world's most influential business thinker in an annual ranking conducted by the Thinkers 50. Clayton, it's truly an honor to have you with us here today.
You're kind.
I'd like to start by having you describe the research that led to your book, The Innovator's Dilemma.
The research that led to The Innovator's Dilemma really had its roots all the way back in my first career, where I organized and ran a company with several MIT professors to commercialize new products that they had developed at their labs at MIT. They were the technical brains, and I was the business guy. And the company has become quite successful, but the competitors were all established major material science companies, such as Alcoa, Celanese, Hoechst, Cabot Corporation, and none of them were successful at it. I always had wanted to be a teacher, so as I hit age 40, decided if I was ever going to be an academic, I better start. So we put the number two person in charge of the company, and I bailed out to become a doctoral student all over again. And I brought this puzzle with me. How could a little company beat the big ones? And it seemed that the answers were a little too simplistic. And then as I thought more broadly, I realized, geez, the companies that are today widely admired as unassailably successful, very successful companies. A decade or two later, often you see them in the middle of the pack and often at the bottom of the heap. And why is success so hard to sustain? So those were puzzles that I brought with me from the company to become an academic. And I started then to try to understand why this was as part of my doctoral thesis.
Clayton, one of the terms that's been very closely associated with you is the concept of disruption, and particularly disruptive technology. Now, in your mind, what is disruptive technology?
Disruptive technology is an innovation that transforms a product which historically was so complicated and expensive that only people with a lot of money and a lot of skill had access to owning it and using it. A disruptive technology transforms that into a product or a service that is so much more simple and affordable that a much larger population of people can now own it and use it. And that's what a disruptive technology is. It's not a breakthrough. It's not different. It has this specific meaning in my work, which is simplicity and affordability.
And along the same lines, how do you manage technological change?
Well, generally, technological change can be deployed in very different ways. So the commercial application typically isn't intrinsic to the technology itself. And so you can take the very same technology and deploy it in the market in what I call a sustaining innovation, making better products even better, or you could deploy it as a disruptive product, enabling people who couldn't own it now to use it. So as an example, in today's world, there are a lot of people who are concerned about global warming and what do we do with sources of green energy. And if you take solar electricity and try to deploy it in North America and Europe and East Asia, it competes against consumption already. There are already ways for getting electricity. And in order for us to use technology, the solar electricity in these markets, it needs to be better than what is available, as reliable and at comparable or lower cost. And we call that a sustaining innovation. Disruptive innovation would take the very same technology and deploy it amongst the 2 billion people in Asia and Africa who don't have access to traditional electricity. That would be disruptive. It competes against non-consumption. And in order for the market, for this new technology to take root, it just needs to be better than nothing. So there isn't anything intrinsic to the technology per se that ordains it as disruptive or sustaining. Typically, that's determined by how you deploy it into a market.
Okay, I have one that has to do with your comment on it being wrong to focus on the most profitable customers and businesses. Clay, why is that the case?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's wrong. It's actually right to do, but choosing what you have to do in the end will kill your company in the end. And so we observe that a disruptive company comes in at the bottom of a market and picks up the least demanding customers or applications in a market. The established company then has to ask itself, should we defend the lowest profit part of our product line, or should we give that up to the disruptor? And what they learn is that, geez, if we lop off the lowest profit part of the product line, when we add up all of the remaining numbers, our profitability improves as we get out. And the disruptive company, as they get in, because they have a lower cost profit model, their profitability improves as they get into that tier of the market. And then the disruptive company introduces its next better product, and the established company looks at that and says, gosh, should we defend the least profitable part of the business or not? And they learned that if they just lop it off their product line and add up the remaining numbers, their profitability improves as they get out. And the entrant company, the disruptor, finds that their profitability improves as they get in. And so they have exactly asymmetrical motivations, one to get out, one to get in. But in both cases, the driver of moving up market is the pursuit of profit. And if you don't do that, then you find that you're competing against much lower cost competitors. And if that's what you try to do, then you lose your profitability and you get killed sooner. So established companies, when disruption emerges in their market, they actually have to go up market. And ultimately, that will sunset. And they will just be at the highest high end of the market where there's not enough capacity to sustain them all. What they need to do is, as they do that, launch or acquire a disruptor so that you can catch the growth that comes from disruption rather than frame it only as a threat.
So this is very much a strategic approach to that possibility.
That's right. That's right.
And Clayton, how can you say that innovation can be a predictable process that delivers sustainable, profitable growth?
That's a great question.
How dare you?
So it is a very important question, because if you think about history, venture capital employs some of the smartest people on the planet. And those guys will see thousands of business plans every day, and through their brains and training, will sift through those and identify a few that they think might become successful. They then will study the industry with all of the brains that they got when they're in MBA programs. They then hire the world's experts to come in and assess the probability that the technology is going to work. And then they do all of these scenarios to figure out the worst and the best possibilities for this thing. And then after all of that, they put their money in. And every time they put their money in, they think it's going to be successful, and only 15% or so actually become truly successful. And isn't that scary? that the smartest people doing the very best things that could possibly be done, in the end, they're right only 15% of the time.
I think odds are actually better on a craps table than that.
A very bad bet, if you look at those odds. Can you make it more predictable? And we really have decided that, in fact, it actually can be predictable, but you need to have theories that will allow you to look into the future. And so one of those theories is disruption. And the reason why that can help you is it doesn't ordain it to be successful, but it does allow you to get rid of one of the uncertainties, and that is, are the competitors going to kill me, or can I kill the competitors? And if you have a disruptive strategy, it takes you to the bottom of the market where, in fact, a little boy can kill a giant because the giant is motivated to flee rather than fight you. So then there's another one that we call jobs to be done, which makes it much more predictable that the product you develop is a product that the customer is going to pull into its life. There really are a set of theories. They don't give it a cookbook yet, but our experience is that when you use the theories, you actually can predict with a much higher degree of certainty that it will or won't work.
How can managers create the right conditions and right times for disruption to be successful in their organizations?
Boy, it's a great question and a very tricky one. So the first thing is they need to attempt this when the company doesn't need it. Because an innovation, a disruptive innovation, doesn't come to fruition in 2 years. It takes 5 to 10 years until it really has proven to have the potential. That means that if the core business is strong today, this is exactly when you want to invest in disruption. If you wait until the core business is sick, and then you say, oh my gosh, we need another strong business to keep our top and bottom line on the growth trajectory that we need, then it demands that this becomes big fast. You can never succeed. So I'd say that's the most important thing that you have to get right in a company when you're looking at disruption, and that is you need to invest in it when you don't need it.
How can you determine if a customer segment is primed for a new offering?
You need to go to the bottom of the market and look at the least demanding of your customers or who used to be your customers and look down there at who's not buying your product anymore. And then ask yourself, what are they buying? And if you see that happening at the bottom of the market, then there's a high probability that there is another competitor starting at the bottom of the market coming up at you. And that's how you would tell that disruption is afoot.
Clayton, we did an interview with a gentleman. He's the CEO of an innovation consultancy a short time ago, and he had a novel approach. It's not only what he called the magic or the creative side, but it's also the money side. And they had an interesting approach, but they only deal with companies in an outsourced type of fashion. What activities should we outsource and which should we keep in-house?
Well, would you mind if I say I don't know?
Nope, that's great.
And let me describe why. And I'll just say it with an example. One of my colleagues here, Willie Shih, just returned from an extensive trip to China. And he went through a plant that makes the logic circuits for almost all of the smartphones in the world, including Apple's. And the one that he was looking at, I can't tell you which of the companies was going to use this, but it was a circuit that had 34 layers in it. And the signals, of course, had to go up and down to the various layers in this subassembly. And the holes that then had to be filled with aluminum in order to send a signal from one layer to the next, and back up to the surface and so on. These holes were 2 microns in diameter. And the machine drilled 2 million holes per minute. And we outsourced the fabrication of our electronics products to China at the beginning because it was lower in cost. Now we outsource to China because we can't do it. And it was thought that when you outsource, what you want to keep in-house was the quote-unquote technology, but technology meant the product technology and our instinct for how to design the products that customers will want. We can outsource manufacturing because it's a lower value-adding activity. I think what's happening, not just in electronics, but in a broad range of products, is the rules for how to design things can be modeled on a workstation. In other words, the difficult technology relative to products has kind of been taken out of the engineers' minds and embedded in design rules in a computer. And actually anybody can do that to near net shape. And the real value adding is in manufacturing, which is just totally flipped from what you would have thought 15 years ago. So in concept, I could sit at Harvard and say, the rule is whatever's going to be modular and well specified, you can outsource that, which is in a static view, it's the right answer. In a dynamic view, however, it's not clear that outsourcing solves competitive problems. I'll just say one other thing about it, and that is we could outsource to lots of people around the world. I'm not obsessed with China, but they're a big player right now. When you go to China for low-cost, simple assembly of a product, say, take it a toy, sit in the CEO of the person who accepted that job from you. Do they want to spend the rest of their lives assembling simple products like toys? They will get killed because the minute you can fabricate a simple product in Vietnam instead of China, boom, the value goes there and you're dead. And so you want to move up market. Every year, develop more and more sophisticated products because it's only going up market that allows you to preserve your competitive advantage. And so you can predict with certainty, driven by the pursuit of profit, that these guys are going to try to become more and more sophisticated. And that's the mechanism by which I think we all of a sudden face this flip and realize, oh my gosh, we have to outsource because we can't do it. And when we can't do it, then their ability to define the terms of trade all of a sudden flips.
And Clay, how do you know if your company is capable of disruptive growth?
I would say I will judge my company is capable of disruptive growth if the senior management are willing to create new business models, new business units that have new different models. If they're not willing to do that, then it doesn't matter how innovative you are in a technology or product realm. You can predict that your company will conform that to fit the company. If they're willing to create new business models, then I'd say, I bet we could do this.
Actually, this follows from what you've just said. What is the role of senior executives to lead new growth?
What they have to do truly is to cultivate the ability to create multiple different types of business models underneath the corporate umbrella. The decision to create a new disruptive opportunity that requires a new business model can only be decided by people at the executive level.
The C-suite.
Yes, that's right. Business units cannot launch disruptive companies because their job is to take every company and use it in a sustaining basis inside of their business. Disruptive opportunities can only be made at the level of the CEO. And that's the most important contribution they can make.
All right, Clay, just to wrap up, is there anything that we've forgotten to ask you about or any additional thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners today?
We haven't talked about the role that finance does in positive and, in my view, more frequently negative role that they play in innovation. And the metrics that they have articulated, like only looking at marginal versus full costs and their use of internal rate of return, or IRR, forces you not to create new businesses and invest in short-term wins rather than long-term creation of new businesses. And I think we need to implicate those guys.
Okay, last question, I really grapple with this. Do you really believe that the CEO should be the chief innovation officer?
Well, or something close. And the reason is that the existing part of the corporation that is established, it ought to be able to run itself if the CEO has good abilities as CEO, because there are processes and decision rules and structures that ought to be able to do that. And if the CEO says, oh, the core business generates 95% of my revenues, so it ought to take 95% of my time, something is wrong.
We've been speaking to Clayton M. Christensen, author of The Innovator's Dilemma. Thanks so much for being with us, Clayton.
You too.
Follow the American Management Association on Twitter to learn about upcoming free programs, the latest news, management insights, and special offers. You can follow us at AMANET. That's AMANET. Hope to tweet to you real soon. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.